Good evening, everybody. James McKinney here with my Science Hour. This is for July 18th, 2024. And really have an interesting show for you tonight. Every week now, I'm going to be talking about science and the condition of science and the real state of science, what's going on in the science world. And it's really crazy, crazy out there. I mean, that's all I can tell you. You have YouTubers who don't know anything about science, who there might be a thousand, who knows how many, YouTube channels, people trying to put pretty pictures up or videos and then talk about things. And, you know, let's just face it, 99.9% of them have absolutely no scientific background at all, let alone formal training, let alone any understanding of physics or mathematics. Basically, if you're going to enter this arena, you have to do your due diligence, you have to do your rigorous training. That means going to school in a physics classroom, going to physics laboratories, because here's the situation. Basic physics, as we know it, is very, very correct and very well defined. So all of a sudden you have somebody that's a movie star, decides he wants to put together little jigsaw puzzles and rewrite basic science and talk about gravity. If you're going to, let me just put it this way. If you're going to try to replace or give commentary regarding science, first of all, you have to know what science says and what it's all about. Then you can take your ideas, whatever they are, but you also have to talk in the language that's been developed over hundreds of years. I've done that. I've done my homework. I have an advanced degree in physics, a master's degree in nuclear and solid state physics. But if you get to that level, you certainly can get a PhD, which I could have, but like I said before, one of the best decisions I ever made was not getting a PhD. What does that do? That buttonholes you into a particular topic, and that's what you have to research on. Your nose is down this narrow tunnel. And I didn't want to do that. I worked in archaeology. I worked in other fields. I worked in telecommunications. I worked as an electrical engineer. I worked on mathematical issues with telecommunications, like encryption and telecommunication protocols, all requiring technical background. But if I would have gotten a PhD, none of this would have happened. If I would have gotten a PhD, I would have never, in a million years, ended up at Cornell University. The way I got to Cornell was because I had been teaching physics, mathematics, and computer science in foreign languages, multiple foreign languages. And so when I got to Cornell, I told the story about how I went up to get my, I was going to apply to get a PhD there. And they said, nope, you don't. We're just filled up for years in advance, and there's no room for you here. But we can hire you as a teacher. And so I was hired onto the faculty. So that would have never in a million years happened if I did not have the technical background. And so that should tell you pretty much everything about the steps that I went through getting my master's degree and then teaching in a university and then going through those steps and then finally being at the right place at the right time. But these like fly-by-night wannabe YouTubers have not done anything. They have never worked the back of a book physics problem. They don't know what is good physics and what the differentiation between that and bad physics, a lot of the physics that occurs in space science and in cosmology is really very bad science. And that's what's crumbling. That's what's falling apart. NASA's head of science got up on a podium and he said, comets are not dirty snowballs. This has been since Kepler, the Middle Ages, since the belief that comets were somehow little fluffy frozen things that melt when they get near the sun. No, they're tremendously hot. They are involved in an electrical discharge in the solar system. How does that happen? Well, that's going to be the main topic tonight as I talk about electricity in outer space. But that's one side of the issue. The other side is that the public does not trust science. Because I just saw a debate. It was not a debate. It was kind of a panel, I would say. Piers Morgan was interviewing three physicists about a new phenomenon. This guy is, I'm not going to go and mention names, but there's a guy who's a movie star who all of a sudden started doing basically artwork, computer artwork, and then started saying, well, this is gravity, and, you know, just stuff that really doesn't make any sense, but got the ear of the internet, and now is exploded all over the place. But what's funny to see is these standard scientists who are trying to put this into perspective and trying to put a basis of criticism, and they can't do it. They can't talk to the public. These scientists are often never land. They're off in their own little worlds, and they can't communicate with the public. They can't bring it down to your level, and that's something that I do very well. Something I've always been known for is I work at very high levels in science. I have peer-reviewed papers. I have textbooks. I have other work that you will find easily on, you know, on the internet, etc. Dealing with history of man, with archaeology, with other topics. But I can communicate with the public. And that's something that's very important. And that's why I'm going through this. Every week I'm going to talk a little bit about the state of science. So that you have the science community, which the public doesn't trust. In fact, NASA, alternative pseudonym for NASA is Never a Straight Answer. Because, and it's really true, NASA has, they put out this information, and since the days of Carl Sagan back in the late 70s, it's like their attitude is, they're smart, you're dumb, they have all the information, you don't, just believe what they say. And that's crumbling under its own weight today, because the Big Bang, after 120 years, is completely false. Their dirty snowball comet model is completely false. They don't know how planets formed. They can't tell you where water or oil came from on the planets. Basic things that you would think that some theory would tell you, those are minimally what they should tell you, and they don't. And so this leaves a gaping hole for internet wannabes to create YouTube pages just talking garbage. But where does that leave you, the public? That leaves you, the public, really in scientific never-never land. There's just no place. That's what this show is about, is to try and put some stability. And that's what my long-term radio show has been all about, is to bring stability and bring some real information to the public. But once again, if you're going to enter the world of science, and that's what I tell people, if you go, I tell people, don't go to YouTube to get your science. Sometimes my work gets posted on YouTube as part of the new television show, which is strictly placed there for people to listen to. It's copyrighted, so it can't be copied or partitioned up and then used by other, you know, entrepreneurs or people who are, let's call them opportunists who want to take my work and somehow, you know, get traffic to their YouTube page or something. In fact, just make a note here, be sure to visit my webpage and see the copyright notices, fair use statements and things like that. My work is not for someone to copy or derive new variations or whatever. My work is very solid. I've had tier one scientists, many of them, come out and talk to me. They ask me sometimes questions that they don't understand, and tier one is what I call military science, and they tell me they are amazed at everything that I do, how correct it is. And so we'll be talking about that tonight. I also want to go through a little bit about peer review, because this is one of the standard things that happens when people start looking at my work, etc. They go, what about peer review? Well, my work is published in peer-reviewed papers, and that is ongoing. There's a dichotomy in peer review today. There's a new group of journals, and you have the old ones like astrophysics and space science, or the old standard physical review that stick to the standard story of science. But there's a new group of journals coming out that are allowing really new solid work. It's peer-reviewed, so you're not going to get some internet wannabe clown trying to get peer-reviewed papers published. It's not going to happen. Peer review has a real purpose, and that is to keep the riffraff out. And today there's more riffraff than you can shake a stick at. Just look at YouTube. But there are some problems historically with peer review, which started seriously in around the 1970s, according to science historians of science. But I wanted to read a couple of these passages here. Now, I've talked about this before, and I just want to go through this. 9 reasons why I no longer submit publications to peer-reviewed journals. And actually, like I say, there are journals that are working diligently to get real information published in this really trying time when all of these long-standing theoretical models are going under. The one of the big reasons is because the referees a lot of time are very outdated. They're supposedly the experts in their field, and if something new comes along, they really, how are you going to submit something to somebody that is stuck in science that's 50 years old? Another issue is that journals take control of the published work, and that's something I don't allow. I own all of my work. Whether it's the show, this show, or the radio show, the TV show, whether it's my books, whether it's my internet page, whether it's DVDs, classes that I give, I own all of that work. And most scientists don't own anything that they have ever done, because the peer-reviewed journals take that away from them. They actually have to ask permission to publish their own material. I don't do that. There's very little real research. If you go out into the real world of in almost every field, very little real work is published in peer-reviewed journals. Especially Tier 1 science is never published in peer-reviewed journals. Let me go through. The peer-reviewed process has been flawed. It's turned into a monopoly for people with grant money and grant the funding publication, the university professors, or people who, say, are resident at a university that work for NASA, for example. It's become a monopoly system where they keep any adversaries out, and that's really bad. That's a very bad thing for science, because then science simply becomes more of the same. If you double or triple the amount of money in science, then you get double or triple the same. Albert Einstein only published 2 papers in the United States. When he came to the U.S., he was at Princeton. He continued writing papers for a very long time until his death in, 1954, I believe it was. But he did not submit them to peer-reviewed journals because he didn't like the process, because it involved other people in judging his work. And he was on the cutting edge, and that's the problem. If you're really on the cutting edge how are you going to submit a periodical a publication to a peer-reviewed journal to somebody that doesn't even know what you're doing? The scientists have lost control of their work. Peer review has been known to be corrupted, and I personally have had an event where a editor-in-chief of a journal, it was when I was at Cornell, Icarus, and I'm not going to go into details, but literally the editor-in-chief stole my material and published it, including the terminology and the names that I used in the work, etc. And here's the last one. I say, peer review is like an old man driving slow in the left lane of a crowded freeway. He has plenty of room in front of him. He just can't figure out why all those people are honking and trying to get around him. So anyway, that's a bit of introduction on the condition of science today. That's a pretty dismal picture of science, something that's supposed to be right and correct and peer-reviewed, to find that it's literally falling apart at the seams. So where does this leave young people? What do you do? And the answer is that you should go to college and get a good solid background. I would say mathematics, physics, and those things where you're at the undergraduate level are very solid. You know, the electronics, the thermodynamics, the gravity, celestial mechanics, understanding the laws of physics. That is very sound physics, and you'll go to the laboratory, and I would say you're better off at a small private school if you can afford it, if you can get the money together. But also, you know, just get a solid background, and then you'll have something to work with, because there's a lot happening in the private world about our space today, very exciting work. Companies growing by leaps and bounds. So there's a lot happening, and the devastation that's going on in the theoretical scientific community dealing with cosmology, etc., is going to we're going to have a number of years where things are really in chaos. Let me put it that way. But like I say, I'll be one of the people that puts order to this. Because actually I had this solved close to 50 years ago. We all knew that the Big Bang was garbage. We all knew that the solar system didn't form all at one time. I knew that comets were not dirty snowballs. So there's a lot happening in the background to restructure science, but it's going to be chaotic for a few years. But get a good solid background in physics or chemistry, or because like I say, at the undergraduate level, that level of physics is very solid. Okay, so now I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to continue talking about electricity in outer space, because if you don't understand this, you don't understand much. And the end result is that NASA really missed the boat. They really don't understand these concepts. And once again, that's left a gaping hole for lots of YouTubers to run around and pretend like they're scientists. So you have this dichotomy, and then NASA has outreach people who come out and say, oh, those people are pseudoscientists. And neither side is correct. And that, once again, leaves you, the public, in the middle of nowhere as far as understanding science. But I want to start out talking about two people who are heads and shoulders above everybody else in the scientific community, a guy named Nikola Tesla and a guy named Albert Einstein. And both of them, Einstein is not as well known for this, but both of them were very much involved in trying to understand electricity in outer space. Nikola Tesla, in the 1800s, the Chicago Fair in the 1800s already had his many, many patents on generation of electricity, on the distribution of electricity, and they lit up the Chicago Fair with light bulbs, much to everybody's amazement. So that kicked off the electrical revolution. Then he also was doing atmospheric electricity research. That was his Wardenclyffe Tower and also the Colorado Springs Research Center, that he was dealing with atmospheric electricity. And I'm going to explain here what Tesla was doing. This also led to what Einstein was doing right before he died. Tesla had so many patents dealing with practical applications of electricity, the transformers, the Tesla coils, the inductors, the understanding how to use magnetic fields and permanent magnets to generate electricity that then could be sent and using alternating current, AC, which we still use today in distributed power, and the advantage over DC, direct current that Edison was trying to promote during those early days of electricity. But Tesla's really interesting work had to do with atmospheric electricity. So the Wardenclyffe Tower was this immense structure that it's hard to describe. I have a book, it's called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, one of my best-selling books of all time. And I discuss in there, as I rediscovered Tesla's work and the theoretical work behind what he was doing, and then I advanced it because I got to understand where the electricity came from that Tesla was experiencing, that he was extracting from the atmosphere. Where did this come from? Tesla did not know. Tesla died in 1944, in the height of World War II. And we don't really know if he died, as stated. It's my belief that he was abducted by the physics science community of Washington, D.C. at the time, because he was on his way to England to sell, basically promote his what was called the death ray. And I talk about that in my education course, where basically he had the ability, and I know how he was doing this, to knock airplanes out of the air. And so anyway, that had to do with his Wardenclyffe Tower project, which, by the way, was torn down in 1917, I believe, during the height of World War I. But anyway, and I'll be talking a lot more about this, bits and pieces of Tesla's work. But basically, Tesla was gathering electricity from the atmosphere and distributing it through the ground. Now, you might go on a lot of YouTube channels that say that he was trying to transmit electricity through the air. That is false. Because where was he supposed to get the electricity to transmit through the air? Well, he had sold all his patents and all of his technology to Westinghouse. And so he had no way to generate electricity because he had sold all of his rights and patents. But in his contract with Westinghouse, he had a very interesting clause that he could use electricity from the grid, which was being constructed at the time. He could use electricity from the grid. And what he was doing was powering up his Tesla tower to drill an electrical hole through the atmosphere. And I talk about this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. So the idea was not to transmit electricity through the air, but through the earth. And he was doing that in his Colorado Springs facility. In fact, he would put out lights all over the desert out of Colorado Springs, and he would gather atmospheric electricity and light up the light bulbs out in the desert. And all the light bulbs had was a wire going down into the ground. Two wires, actually, one coming out of each side. But one night he got a little too much energy going and blew out a local power station for one of the local power grids, which he had to pay for. And so anyway, the end result was that Tesla was gathering atmospheric electricity, but he did not know where it came from. He knew there was a vertical electric field, which is very high. It's a few hundred volts per meter, which is extremely high. That means from the tip of your head down to your toes, there's a few hundred volts in the atmosphere, but the question is, why doesn't it discharge? And the answer is that the air in the atmosphere is a dielectric. It's a very good dielectric, which means it is like a medium that prevents the capacitor from discharging. And so anyway, this has to do with electrical theory, etc. But that was Tesla. Now let me talk about Einstein for a few minutes. Einstein was looking for the unification of the fields. This is a theoretical, very esoteric theoretical field, still unsolved. How do the various fields, how are they coordinated? How could you coordinate them mathematically? So we have the gravitational field, we have the electric fields, we have the strong and the weak nuclear forces, and then there are other forces known about in nature in the subatomic world. But how are these related? And that's what Einstein was working on. But he knew something was going on in outer space having to do with electricity. But, of course, Einstein died back in the mid-50s, long before the space age, long before understanding the real conditions of the sun, etc. And I'll throw in a little bit of a note here also. When I was at Cornell, I had quite a few conversations with a man named Hans Bethe, who was instrumental in understanding the fusion processes in the sun. That was what he won a Nobel Prize for. He was also on the Manhattan Project. And I'd go up and talk to Hans, and he would talk to me also about Albert, his good friend Albert Einstein. But they understood that there were some problems with the core fusion model of the sun, which he helped invent, which he helped was part of the work they worked on when they were at Los Alamos, understanding the processes for fusion in the sun. So anyway, Einstein was looking for the unification of the fields. And he happened to be very good friends with a guy named Emanuel Velikovsky, who was also living in Princeton, one of Einstein's neighbors. And Velikovsky had been studying ancient texts which talked about electricity in outer space. Vast amounts of electricity dealing with, events, and I'm not going to go into that right now. But anyway, when Einstein died, everything was pushed aside on his desk, and in the middle of his desk was the book open, and he was reading it. It was Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. So why was he interested in that? Well, I happened to be privy to this because a good friend of mine, Warner Sizemore, who I had basically a lifetime of communication with him back from the 1970s when I was at Cornell. After I was at Cornell, I ended up publishing a good deal of my work in a peer-reviewed journal that was edited by Warner Sizemore, who just happened to be Velikovsky's personal secretary. So I know that he was there when Einstein would come over and play his violin, and then they'd have supper. But Einstein was interested in electricity in outer space because he understood that was part of his understanding of the unification of the fields, which was a highly, like I say, esoteric portion of research in basic physics at the time. Okay, we're going to go back in history a little bit here and talk about what the original theories regarding the sun and the Big Bang, what were some of those original theories? And how did they get twisted and bent over time? Well, this goes back to World War II and actually before, when they were trying to figure out what caused the sun to ignite and to glow. I mean, what was this process? And it actually goes all the way back to Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton did a very interesting experiment. He took a known amount of light from the sun through an aperture, and he showed it on a beaker of water and with a black background, and it was absorbing the heat from the sun and heated up the water. And then he measured that temperature rise so he could determine the amount of heat that was coming, the amount of energy, heat is energy, is another term for energy, coming from the sun. And then he backtracked, he calculated back, and he said, okay, take 360 degrees around the sun like a sphere and imagine that all of that energy is meeting this sphere. So how much energy is the sun producing? And then he could also calculate the amount of energy per unit, per square unit on the surface of the sun. And it was more energy, like by a lot, like a million times or more. You know, that's just a round, that's a figurative number, that than a chemical fire, like a wood fire or some kind of fire that we're accustomed to on planet Earth. So he knew that something was going on in the sun that was radically different than the any type of reaction, chemical reaction or fire that we were accustomed to on planet Earth. And so that eventually, when scientists started understanding fusion and the Manhattan Project, a lot of advancements were made during that time, understanding the fusion process. And they understood that to kick off the fusion reaction, you needed to compress the hydrogen to kick it off. And so anyway, there were two bombs that they made in the Manhattan Project. One was a fission product, the other one was a fusion product, and they both worked. So they imagined that it took a great deal of pressure to kick off the fusion reaction, and the only place you would get that would be in the core of the sun. However, there were some other things going on. Like I said, I talked to a guy named Hans Bethe, who won a Nobel Prize for this, who was on the Manhattan Project, and they knew there were some issues with that fusion model. And so at any rate, what I came up with was the idea that the fusion was not in the core, but in the atmosphere of the sun. And that was actually proven when I was working with Russian scientists in the mid-1990s. They did an experiment, a very interesting experiment. I describe it in one of my books. I think it's in the Principia Meteorologia book. But anyway, they were able to detect X-rays deeper and deeper down in the atmosphere of the sun. And what they discovered was that as you rose in altitude in the sun's atmosphere, it got hotter and hotter. And as you went down in the atmosphere, it got colder and colder in terms of X-rays, until you got to the core of the sun, which was the coldest, which meant that the fusion was not going on in the core. And I had already theoretically proposed that the fusion was in the atmosphere. And that raises a whole nother question of how did the, there's not much atmosphere there, so how does this thing keep burning? And it turns out there's an answer to that. The sun is actually garnering hydrogen and other low mass chemicals from the galactic environment. And that's what the Russian scientists actually had been working on when they got a hold of me and started picking apart my work. But anyway, the point of talking about the original theories is because when they originally calculated what the surface of the sun should look like, it should have been a smooth, perfectly smooth orange ball. And back in the 50s, the 40s and 50s, when you looked at the sun with equipment, that's what you saw. They did not have the high-resolution telescopes, etc., that we now have today. And so all of the surface structure on the sun, including tornadoes, which the Russians observed back in the 90s, 10 years before NASA ever paid attention to it, they did not understand what was going on, what was causing this. So that's why they were very interested in my work, is because my work actually explained this. And I was very clear that the fusion reaction was up in the atmosphere of the sun. Now, this was also supported by the fact that when the Voyager spacecraft went by Jupiter and then Saturn, they were reported to have a fusion proton-based wind coming up off the surface, but they didn't know it was due to fusion. I did. But the both Jupiter and Saturn are small stars. They're unlit in the visible spectrum, but they give off a tremendous amount of light in the infrared. So they're giving off a lot of heat energy, And that's because of the fusion, and then they also have all the electrical properties that the sun has. So there again, you have items that have no core and certainly don't have enough pressure in their cores to meet the requirements for a core fusion model, but they have fusion. So that is another proof, very solid proof, that fusion is going on in the atmosphere of the planets. In fact, there's new work going on right now dealing with very high energy processes that are continuous in the sun that they're just beginning to detect. So anyway, that's another story for another day. But let's then go back to the Big Bang. And the reason I'm telling you this is because the surface of the sun, according to the original core fusion model, was a perfectly smooth orange ball. And the reason for that is because if the fusion reaction is in the core, then there's something called the random walk. It's a basic mathematics problem in physics where something moves, and here's the situation in the sun. If you have X-rays being produced because of the fusion reaction, they don't have very far to go before they're reabsorbed, and then they are re-emitted. And what happens, it takes about a million years for that energy to rise up to the surface of the core of the sun, and then it's emitted out relatively quickly through the atmosphere and then out to us. But the problem is because of that long time with this random walk process of the energy trying to leave the core of the sun, that means that the surface of the sun, the atmosphere, should be perfectly smooth and not have any structure at all. But then when we get good telescopes and look at the surface of the sun, it has immensely complicated structure. In fact, when they developed that model, they didn't know about the solar wind. They didn't know about the coronal holes. They didn't know anything about the sun. All they knew is this hot orange ball up there in the sky. So the original model fit the original data. But then when the real data came in on the fine structure of the surface of the sun, it didn't match. But they swept the data under the rug, as they always do. And okay, so the same thing happened with the Big Bang and the so-called microwave background radiation, which is supposedly a remnant of the Big Bang. But if you do the calculations, the microwave background radiation should be very smooth, very, very smooth, just like the surface of the sun for the core fusion model. But it's not. When they finally sent up the COBE satellite, was around the late 1980 time frame. It took a picture of the microwave background around the solar system, and it was very blotchy. So all of a sudden, oops, they had data that was contradictory, so they fixed it. They actually had a Nobel Prize given for the guy who fixed it and made it all okay again. And this is what's been going on, unfortunately, in the scientific community for all of these decades, and literally 120 years in the case of the Big Bang. Every time new contradictory data came in, they fixed it, swept everything under the rug, and everything was good to go again. But finally, the James Webb Telescope is finally producing data that is showing that the Big Bang simply does not work. Okay, so now we're talking about atmospheric fusion, and there's another process going on. Well, what is causing the fusion to burn in the atmosphere of the Sun and Jupiter and Saturn? It turns out they are energetic lightning bolts. And what happens is, if you've ever seen a lightning bolt, it doesn't follow a straight line, it follows a jagged line through the atmosphere. And it's in those bends where a process known as the pinch effect causes the very high pressure, the magnetic pressure, to kick off the fusion reaction in the atmosphere. So it's an electric fire. And now we're getting back to what Tesla and Einstein were trying to understand, but died before the real data was available. If they would have lived longer, they would have probably discovered this. But when I came along, I realized that electricity and magnetism in outer space were very essential to the processes going on. And so, where does the atmospheric lightning come from, or the atmospheric electricity that Tesla was actually collecting and distributing through the ground? It comes from a capacitor between the ground and the ionosphere. And so, this is a complicated electrical circuit, and there's only one source of power, because in outer space, in the Earth, in physical electronics, electric currents don't just keep flowing forever by themselves. They simply do not do that. They require power. They require a source of energy. So in the case of, for example, if you have a flashlight, eventually your flashlight is going to stop running because the battery ran out of electricity. And so the same is true of the solar system, of the planet Earth's electric field, the vertical electric field that Tesla was looking at. And so the end result is there's only one source of electrical power in the solar system, and that's the sun. The sun is fusion reaction is also creating the electric fields, and it does that by a complicated process of charge separation, but it starts with those lightning bolts that are in the atmosphere of the sun. And you can hear those lightning bolts in a sense, they're called whistlers. That's a term that they coined actually at Venus, where lightning bolts are occurring in the atmosphere, but then you see them at Jupiter and at Saturn in the atmosphere. And they're also associated with the Great Red Spot. And there are locations where the fusion is occurring in the atmosphere of Jupiter and Saturn. So anyway, this conversation is going to go on and on, but the point of talking about this early in this series of shows is because without electricity, we would not have storms, we would not have thunderstorms, we would not have rain, we would not have clouds, we would not have wind, we would not have any weather at all. And this is very bizarre because the meteorologists don't understand what causes weather. They think that hurricanes are caused by warm water, an absolutely absurd idea that somehow a warm body of water generates this concentrated energy system we call a hurricane. Absolutely absurd. And then they come up with all these excuses for why hurricanes may form or may not form, and they make predictions. Absolutely silly science. Silly science. And so the meteorologists have no idea what causes weather, and so how can they predict the weather if they don't know what causes the weather? Take a second to check out the webpage, jmcanniescience.com. The short URL is jmccsci.com. My latest release, eDVD, Eclipse, the New Cosmology, goes through all of the things that you have to know to understand this radical change that is really taking place right now, and with the Big Bang simply going away overnight, something I did not expect. We knew 50 years ago that the Big Bang did not work, but finally the James Webb Telescope data is putting it to rest. Go visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. So I want to mention something. We're going to continue these topics of electricity in outer space, atmospheric electricity in the planets, including planet Earth, the cause of weather. But I want to mention that last week I talked about the Nazca Lines on this show, and boy, somebody's listening, because the airwaves were filled with stories about Nazca Lines. So that tells me that I'm being heard out there, let's put it that way. People are watching, and the disinformation that has been passed off to you, the public, let's just put it that way. I call it the garbage science that's passed off to you, the public, is alive and well. And they're a little worried about this show because it's going to get a lot more air time. But it's interesting to see that when I touch on topics here, immediately the disinformation crews have to come in with the white horses and the white hats, I call them, on their white horses, to try and save the day and make sure you don't get the real information about what's going on. But imagine that the people that I don't know if they're people. We don't even know if they were like human people or whoever. Nobody knows. But thousands of years before the Incas, somebody was building fractal antenna transmission and receiving arrays in the middle of the desert in Peru. Very powerful information. And of course, standard archaeology does not know anything about this. And why would they? Because they think that they are like little paths for prayers or walking around where the people just walked around in circles or something. Absolute nonsense. But that's what they want to feed you, the public, is a lot of nonsense. So once again, I just want to remind you, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and click on the education package. I want parents, grandparents, or students, ask your parents to look at this for you. And I have the education supplemental package is called K-12 University Science Supplemental Package, and it goes through hundreds of lectures dealing with these very topics, my books, how to read my books, how and all of the coursework that I have, all the CDs, DVDs are included in the package. And so I encourage you to check that out. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on products at the top of the page and go there. And it's going to take a little while to read this. Don't go to my page expecting to spend. It's not like a TikTok page where you're going to get the message in 15 seconds. It's not like that. It's 15 gigabytes of information there and growing. And it's for people that really want to know what's going on. So just a quick mention here. Now, this is an email from a listener. In fact, I've gotten quite a few of these. It says, this one particularly says, you should be aware that YouTube is auto-deleting any and all posts, even with the mere mention of your name, at least on some, if not all, YouTube channels. Well, I guess popularity has its downsides. But this has been going on, by the way, and you can all go out and experiment with this. Go out to your favorite YouTube channel, whatever it is. Doesn't matter if it's fixing a bicycle or some clown pretending he's a scientist. And just type my name in. Type a little blog comment under the video and say, something James McCanny, you know, or James McCanny mentions this, or you should read James McCanny's work or anything. Just mention my name. And so what's going to happen is when you click to save that, it's very interesting. I mean, they're very sophisticated about doing this, because you click that, and then if you go back from that same computer that you put the blog note, if you go back to YouTube, you will see your message there. Now, go to your phone or any other device with a different MAC address and go to that same set of blogs under the same video, and it won't be there. So what they do is they fool the person that put in the blog note thinking that their message is still there, but it's not. It's for everybody else, it's not there. And that's been going on for years. And of course, I'm aware of this. And you have to understand that YouTube is owned by the CIA. CIA owns all of social media. And that's why they don't like Elon Musk owning Twitter and opening it up for everybody to say what they want. Those platforms were used very effectively over the last 5-6 years to influence people, not only, let's name a subject, COVID, political elections, favoring certain people, muddying up people's names, etc. These come out of basically the CIA is who they've always been. They're the police force of the World Bank. That's who the CIA is. They have nothing to do with the United States at all. They're housed in the United States. They get a minor budget, And it's like Congress sends them some money, but the real money of the CIA comes from all of these. It looks like Mark Zuckerberg is the owner of something. No, Facebook or whatever. These are just the poster childs. I want to read a clip here talking about Eisenhower, who did not want anything to do with the CIA. And of course, Kennedy came after Eisenhower, and we all know the story there, that Kennedy was going to get rid of the CIA completely until he had a misfortune in Dallas, Texas. But the original Wild Bill Donovan and the Dulles Boys starting the CIA, nobody really in the civilian part of the government liked this. What none of them understood was that the CIA was part of the Nazi hierarchy that came in under Operation Paperclip. And they really didn't realize the level of infiltration in the U.S. government. Here's a quote from Abbott Smith. He was an analyst who was in the position of Office of National Estimates, said that we had constructed for ourselves a picture of the USSR, and whatever happened had to be made to fit this picture. Intelligence estimators can hardly commit a more abominable sin. And so anyway, the whole CIA thing should have never gotten started, but it was, like I say, none of these people understood who the CIA was, and they're still the same piece of crap. They're involved in international human trafficking, drug trafficking, and you name it in terms of corruption. They are involved in it on an international scale, including fixing elections. And so, including in the United States, believe me. So, at any rate, to understand that the CIA owns YouTube, and YouTube has been shadow banning me since its inception, because they don't want scientists to be independent. A scientist is supposed to wear a skinny little tie and sit in his little laboratory and do what he's told and not make any waves. And so I don't, that's not me, as you probably know, if you know anything about me. I don't kowtow to these a-holes. Let's just put it that way. That's the best term I can use. And they think they run everybody, and they think they run everything. But make no mistake about it, the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. That's who they are. They have nothing to do with the United States. So they operate the world banking cartel, and they also run a little operation called InQtel. And what that is, remember Q? This is all CIA stuff, believe me. Boy, they're good at what they do. They fool most people. But they run this operation, which is a money laundering scheme for all of their illegal money. They take that money and then they buy high-tech companies. Originally, it was mainly in what they call remote sensing, in other words, cameras, satellites, anything where you could get information remotely. They invested in those companies, and these companies got purchased up at very high prices. So some people who are working in these small private companies doing technology on remote sensing got purchased at very, very handsome prices. And then, of course, the CIA comes in and owns that company and the technology, and they take it over. And there have been people that approached me regarding my trying to get the wing generator and things like that, investments. And I'm pretty savvy about this, so I don't kowtow to those people because they stink. They come in with a story and they just smell from a distance, like a, anyway. So no, I don't cater to those people. But they've tried in many different ways to try and influence me or compromise me. This has been going on for a very, very long time because they don't like me. Why would they not like me? Well, because I'm not their good little boy. I'm not their little science boy that does his job and loses all my work in peer-reviewed published journals where I don't own my material. anyway, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail there, but it's important for you to know, and you better believe that they had something to do with the shooting on Trump. They just about killed the guy the other day. 1 inch difference, Trump would be dead. They shot Reagan. They shot Kennedy. You know, yeah, that's who the CIA is. It was very well known that all of the impeachment, you know, the Russian collusion, all of that about Trump was coming out of the CIA. You know, and of course the FBI works for the CIA. They're one and the same. The FBI comes under the CIA. In fact, all government agencies come under the CIA. In fact, they pick presidents. They install presidents. It's very interesting when Hillary Clinton lost in the 2016 election, the very first person she blamed was George Bush Sr. because he was supposed to have the election fixed for her. You know, she didn't have to go out and campaign. That was, she was just had the skids greased for her to become president. But she didn't. And they're not going to let that happen again. They're going to do everything under the sun to get their man in D.C. And, of course, Biden is just a, you know, he's an imposter. There's some actor standing in for Biden. And I can't believe how all these people talk about Biden and, oh, he's, you know, dementia. That's an act. This guy's an actor. You know, that ain't Biden. Biden hasn't, you haven't seen the real Biden for a long time, believe me. Anyway, okay, so moving on here. I want you to do something and then also tell people when you do this. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. At the very top, it says educational. Scroll, put your mouse cursor on that, and down will drop a menu dealing with books, etc. And then when you put your mouse cursor on that, another green banner will pop up to the right side, and it says Science Education K-12 University Program. And what I want you to do is look at that in detail. It took 4 years to put that together. I did an extra lecture every week for 4 years. Plus, it includes all my books, DVDs, all the information, plus 1 year of my radio show. Remember, I took the year 2022. And every week on this radio show, I had the a lecture about the history of my discoveries. So go there, check that out, and then click on it. There's a 30% discount right now on those products, and you get an extra 5% discount using the coupon code JMCC. I'm out of time here, so we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.